a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, ah, to share each lovely day. And through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes and I'll see you with my heart.
Darling, you say you want to write a book? Well, then you must listen to Writers on Writing, darling. Authors, literary agents gabbing and babbling about the art and the business of writing. Thursdays, 5 p.m. Darling, you must. Barbara DeMarco Barrett, she hosts. Yeah, listen, darling.
On KCI-FM in Irvine.
Planetary Radio is Public Radio's only weekly series about space exploration. I'm Matt Kaplan. And I hope you'll join me as we explore Mars, look for life in the universe, and fly through the rings of Saturn. We'll talk with the men and women, scientists and dreamers who are guiding us to a future beyond Earth. And don't forget to enter our weekly space trivia contest. That's Planetary Radio, Mondays at 5:30 p.m. right here on KUCI.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org, and we're available via podcast, either through iTunes or always at Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. If you can't catch us live, we're still available to you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There are more than 150 interviews posted now, and new ones are added a few times each week, so be sure and check them out. I'm your host, Marie Stone. I've been in for Barbara for much of this month, but she'll be back with you next week. As always, Writers on Writing features conversations with authors, poets, agents, publishers, all those folks responsible for putting books in the world and into our lives. Tonight promises to be yet another great show. I'm here with the very funny, very talented David Israel, author of Behind Every Man. And please stay with me because Chandra Prasad will be joining me for the second half of the show. Two wonderful authors talking about their books, their craft, their art. So let's delve in. David Israel studied music composition as an undergraduate and upon graduation went to work for Leonard Bernstein's estate in 1991. Among others, David helped edit and publish definitive editions of West Side Story, On the Town, Wonderful Town, and Mass. David's own music has been commissioned by Paul Taylor and Twyla Tharp and has been premiered by orchestras such as the American Symphony Orchestra. In 2005, Random House published David's first novel, Behind Every Man, which is now being turned into a feature film. In addition to running a small magazine in Los Angeles, David teaches fiction writing and keeps up a blog at mentalfloss.com. His personal essays and humor pieces have appeared in many magazines and newspapers, including the New York Times and the LA Times. His latest novel, The Art of Love, a satire of the publishing business, religion, and Hollywood, to name a few, is presently making the rounds. Let's bring him on. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. I should share with our listeners that there's a baby due on your doorstep sort of at any moment now.
Yeah, so. In fact, I've got the bat phone right here, and if it goes off, you might have to find somebody to fill.
Be a lot of dead air. Please don't do that to me.
Yeah, let's hope.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time, because I know there's a lot going on in your life.
My pleasure. Thanks.
So let's first start with Behind Every Man. Can you talk about the genesis of that novel and sort of how it came to be?
Sure. I had written a couple novels which did not sell. So that should be a great lesson for all those would-be writers out there. And the Behind Every Man was kind of the best parts in some ways of those two books. But it really came together quite quickly. I was in a one of those little bookstores at the train station, and I was looking for a good kind of answer to chick lit from the guy's perspective. And I noticed that there weren't any. I mean, there were all these books kind of marketed to women. Of course, women do buy many more books than men do. But I thought, other than Nick Hornby, and they were kind of out of stock. The Hornby, and I'd already read his books. There wasn't really anything, and I thought, maybe I'll write one and fill that void. And this is kind of before Monkey Love and the whole kind of lad lit thing caught fire. And I guess I got on the train at the right time, literally. So on that train to visit my parents, I was headed from Penn Station in New York to 30th Street in Philadelphia. I started writing a book, and 7 weeks later, it was done.
7 weeks later. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Well, I should say that the first two novels took about 3 years to write. So.
Okay.
Yeah, this was a fluke.
This gives us hope. And you also, I heard, had sort of another fluke, although you say there's a long series of leading up to this, but you also had a fluke in getting this published also that took place on a train. The train holds good things for you. So.
That's right. The New York City Underground was a very magical year for me. I was on, this was before I had written the book, and I was on, I think, the 4 train to Brooklyn. And I noticed the girl sitting next to me had a Random House tote bag with her. And we struck up a conversation. I probably accosted her, and, I'm sure she was accosted by other writers, every writer trying to peddle their manuscript in New York. But we remained in touch. I think she gave me her card. I think I rode a couple extra stops, much further into Brooklyn than I needed to go, and got her card and probably sent her the first novel, probably sent her the second novel, over a long period of time, kept in touch and kept kind of getting, it's okay, but reactions from her. And then I showed her, what became one of the chapters from Behind Every Man, and it was pretty instantaneous.
Amazing. We should all ride more trains, apparently.
Yeah.
Now the novel is written in second person, entirely in second person, which is unusual, but it was really particularly effective in this case. Was it maybe talk about how you chose that and whether or not it was kind of easy to remain there, or were there times that you were tempted to shift out of it into first or third?
Yeah, it's interesting. I get that question quite frequently, especially from my students who think that it's so challenging to write in second person. But I had been reading a lot of Laurie Moore, who's one of my idols, and she writes in second person frequently. So it was kind of in my head at the time, and it was not difficult. In fact, it was the opposite. The book is a comedy, and the second person enabled me to be funnier than I thought first or third could, because you can be so surreal, especially when you're in the imperative version of second person. Bright Lights, Big City is written in second person, but it's never instructive. It's never like a how-to book. It's never telling you to do something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So for in my case, using the imperative second person, if I as the author tell the protagonist to do something. I mean, don't forget in the book there are two distinct voices. There's the author's voice, which is me, instructing, and then there's the protagonist who's actually doing. Mm-hmm. So if I instruct him to throw an oar, as it says in one chapter, obviously I don't mean he's in the subway. I don't mean him literally to get a fishing, you know, a boating oar and throw it. But it's kind of a funny little metaphor or symbol, if you will. So in my case, I used second person because I found that I facilitated the humor in the book. As it does in Laurie Morris, too, I think.
It does, yeah. It was very reminiscent of self-help, both in the second person and in the how-to style, which I guess those kind of walk hand in hand. But I love Laurie Moore, and so it was such a pleasure to pick this up.
Yeah, I can tell you that it's being turned into a feature film now, and they're having a lot of trouble translating the humor in the second person, the humor from the author's POV to the screenplay, because obviously you don't want to. I mean, I think they did that in Bright Lights, Big City, where they had like Michael J. Fox constantly narrating in the second person, but that wasn't a comedy.
Right. Yeah, I was going to ask you how the movie is going and how it is being translated. Are you writing the screenplay, or is it being done by somebody?
I'm not. No, they got somebody who's much more qualified, thankfully. And it's going well. I saw a draft of the script, and pretty different, but not so different that you like throw up your hands and say, "Ah, Hollywood!" No, it's not blasphemy by any stretch, and it's funny in its own way. It's very, very funny. So our fingers are crossed that it'll get made.
Excellent, excellent. I also want to talk about writing humor, because you're obviously very good at it, and I think it's sometimes difficult to sustain. You have a very definitive voice throughout the novel and throughout your blog and throughout your articles. So I know it just kind of flows naturally to you. But I also know that there are times, there are some serious moments in Behind Every Man and some serious subject matters. And you do a very effective job of maintaining your voice and maintaining the humor while coming at it from, kind of a darker place. Can you talk a little bit about writing humor and the kind of transitions out of it, when you need to get out of it, and if there are any drawbacks you find to writing humorously, if it then becomes kind of expected of you?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. It's and my new novel, The Art of Love, which is a play on an Ovid book, which gets referenced a lot in my book. Interestingly, the Ovid is also funny. I mean, you wouldn't think that Ovid would be funny, but a lot of his poems were. And this one is kind of a how-to book for how to catch a woman and keep her, as Ovid says. Mm-hmm. So I'm drawn to humor. I think it comes easily and naturally. In the case of Behind Every Man, I was actually laughing while I was writing it, and that was a good sign. Like, if I could make myself laugh out loud, then somebody else might be able to as well. In fact, I remember I met the girl who's now my wife after I had sold the book, and we took a trip. We were on a plane somewhere, and I gave her the manuscript. This was while Random House was still editing it. Before I got the galleys, and I'm reading it over her shoulder, and this is obviously a book I wrote, I edited, I'd seen a million times, and I was still laughing out loud reading it, almost as if I didn't read it, like here was a new book that I was enjoying and laughing at. So that was a great sign.
That's a good sign, yeah.
But there's definitely pressure once you start writing humor to be funny and to be consistently funny, and I found that actually was a hindrance in writing the new book, which also has lots of humor in it because it's a satire, but it's a much more serious, it's a headier book.
Mm-hmm.
So you raise a good point. Like, David Sedaris, when he's not funny, you kind of go, well, that wasn't that funny.
Right.
Even though it's written really, really well,
exactly.
And the story is really, really interesting, you still go, oh, that wasn't that funny.
Exactly, exactly.
And I'm sure he hates that too.
Yeah, yeah. I want to get into your new book in a minute, but before we leave Behind Every Man, I'm always curious about the author's favorite passage, and in hearing your voice in your own work, and because we've told everybody how funny it is, we should It would only be fair of us to let let the audience hear some of it. So do you mind reading to us a little bit?
I'd be happy to. I'll say it's probably not my favorite passage, but it's the right length. So
I gave you constraints, so we...
Yeah, it fills the slot as you asked me to, and hopefully it is also funny.
Thank you.
One rainy evening, on your way home from the gym, spot an attractive, umbrella-less woman standing on the corner of 10th and University. You've often fantasized about this moment, wondering if you'd have the guts to follow through when the opportunity presented itself. Just as you've rehearsed over the years, get up the nerve to say, "Which way are you headed?" When she replies, "Union Square," tell her that you're headed that way too. A complete fabrication, but it's only a few blocks out of your way, and the village voice she's using to shield the rain is disintegrating quickly. Her name will be Justine, or perhaps Sheila. No, definitely Justine. She'll be a lawyer on her way home from work. "I do M&A work," she'll say, as if that's supposed to mean something to you. She'll be grateful that you shared your umbrella, and spend far more time saying goodbye to you at Union Square than one normally would. Take this as a hint and ask her if she'd like to meet for coffee or tea sometime. "I'll meet you for a drink," she'll say, "but let's make it a scotch." Smile at the thought of this. Only one other person you know drinks scotch. Wonder if kissing her goodnight on the cheek will remind you of kissing your geriatric grandfather, Mortimer. The following week, a beer in your hand, a scotch in hers, discover that Justine left her last boyfriend because she didn't like the way he proposed to her. Or to clarify, her girlfriends didn't like the way he proposed to her. "It's not about the size of the stone," she'll say, rattling the ice at the bottom of her glass. "Anyone can throw a lot of money into a ring. It's about the gesture." Let her chiseled features and ravishing lips blind you from seeing this as a potential problem. Tell her you couldn't agree more, that if you ever proposed to her, you'd jump out of an airplane and parachute onto her roof with a Cracker Jack ring in your teeth. Two drinks later, after you've heard all about her 3-week vacation in Paris, where she spent more time in Chanel than anywhere else, she'll ask what rocks your world, what gets you juiced. Say, "Oh, God, you know, lots," and take a big swig from your bottle of Guinness. "Like what?" Another swig. "Well, let's see. I like sporty things." "Oh, you mean like Ralph Lauren's polo line?" Smile. Wonder what you're doing with this girl. "Well, no, not exactly, though I do have a polo shirt." "Of course you do. A lousy knockoff so obvious even you can tell the difference. The polo guy's supposed to be mounted on a horse, not an aardvark." She'll down some more scotch and then look at her watch. Force a smile. Feel like an imitation of yourself. Like that radio at your parents' house with the genuine simulated wood grain cabinet sticker that no one's ever removed. Tell her that by sporty, you mean water skiing, hiking, basketball, and camping. "Really," she'll say, "I play racquetball." The following week, discover that "I play racquetball" means someone gave me an expensive racket for my birthday. Flossing your teeth would burn more calories than an hour on the court with Justine. Nevertheless, pretend you're enjoying yourself, and most important, be patient with her. Use the calmest voice at your disposal when explaining for the 10th time the concept of holding on to the racket after it hits the ball. Remember, it's not about exercise, it's about doing something fun together. Later that evening, go to a fine sushi place she knows and a few blocks away from the gym. Discover that "fine" actually means one spicy tuna hand roll costs more than you make in a week. When she asks why you're not ordering more, say, "You know, it's hard for me to eat a big meal after such an invigorating workout." After you've eaten your lone hand roll and have downed the entire carafe of sake for two, sit quietly as Justine eats. "So," she'll say in between bites of what looks like the most delicious unagi you'll ever pay for, "tell me more about you. What else do you like besides sports?" Take your time with this one. After all that sake on an empty stomach, thoughts will appear to be much larger than they actually are. Say, "Children." "Children," she'll gasp, swallowing a piece of ginger. "You've heard this before. Women always think you're joking around, throwing them that sensitive line just to get them into bed. But you're not. You have a soft spot for children, and according to the women you date, it's unusual." When the check comes, remarkably, she'll offer to pay half. "You barely ate anything at all," she'll say. "It's only fair." Following evening, call her to make plans for another date. Be caught off guard when she sounds uninterested. After some small talk about racquetball accessories, inquire if something's wrong. "Actually, now that you ask, yes, I'm a bit upset." What happened? I thought we had a pretty good time last night. Stand there stupefied as she explains that she doesn't want to see you anymore. She talked it over with her girlfriends, and they convinced her that you're a cheapskate. Not paying for dinner the first time you were out together is a red flag she just can't ignore. She's dated frugal men in the past, and she wants no part of it. But you offered to pay half. You said I didn't eat much. That was only fair. Yeah, well, I didn't expect you to take me up on it. According to Justine, she'd rather you take her out to McDonald's and pay the entire bill yourself than take her to a fancy restaurant and expect her to pay half. Remember when I told you about my ex, she'll continue? Were you listening? It's not about the money, it's about the gesture. When she drops the obligatory, well, have a nice life, hang up, wishing she could see the gesture, you're presently giving the phone.
I should have turned my microphone off so that people couldn't hear me laughing. That's great. That was David Israel reading from his novel, Behind Every Man, published by Ballantine Books. That's fabulous. Now, I heard there was another book, and maybe that became The Art of Love, although now that I know the Ovid reference, it feels hard. But it was called the Pervert, the Hypochondriac, and the Feminist. Is that the same novel, or is it?
No, it's okay. Absolutely completely different. And it's interesting because Random House, Ballantine had offered this two-book deal, and we wound up turning it down and just going with the one. But obviously, as you probably know, publishers always get the first look at the new book. Mm. So I turned in the manuscript, and they said, I remember my editor sending me this email that said, "You're a genius, but we can't sell this." It was much too racy, and they thought that it went in a completely different direction than they were trying to market me as an author, and that I would lose the audience for Behind Every Man. So it didn't sell, and we took it around to a couple other houses and got some nibbles, but never sold. And I started to revise it, and I said, you know, I got a better idea for a book. And you know, when I get into something, it happens pretty quickly. So we pulled that one off, and I started on the new one.
Too bad, because I thought I could relate to the other one pretty well. I fit into all three of those categories.
Hopefully the feminist.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of me in all those categories, I think. And I saw that you taught a course on the 12-week novelist, and given that you wrote Behind Every Man in 7 weeks, I think we could all benefit from that class. I love the subtitle, which is Start and Finish Your Novel in 3 Months. Really? Really?
Well, that's Media Bistro's marketing department. I didn't write that part.
Well, maybe you could share just a few of the highlights of how you work. If you, I know you're a believer, or by the look of the course description, you're a believer in outlining. Are there kind of some key highlighted points you could share with us on how to approach a novel?
Well, you know, again, that copy is something that Media Bistro writes, and while I do teach outlining in the course, and as I also do with my private students, I don't, you know, I'm not with the ruler and slapping people on the hand if they don't write one, and in the cases where I've written outlines, and sometimes I do and sometimes I don't, I always deviate. You know, I always go off course, and in fact, those are usually the most exciting moments when I'm just writing spontaneously.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, what was the question again?
I just thought maybe you could share a couple of highlighted points from the course with us on how you recommend people get started.
Yeah. The thing that I emphasize the course. I teach I lecture for about 20 minutes or 30 minutes out of the 3 hours, and it's kind of a technical lecture where I'm talking about writing technique, and then we kind of get into workshopping the books. But what I always emphasize in the course, and with anybody who's trying to write a novel, is really just don't take the rejections hard. You know, and whether it's the rejection from your students in the class because they didn't like the submission for this week, whether it's rejections from agents, whether it's rejections from publishers, newspapers, whomever you're writing for, just you can't take it personally. And I can give you some anecdotes to back that up. When I had this interest from Random House for Behind Every Man, I said to Danielle Durkin, who became my editor there, I don't have an agent. I didn't have an agent at the time. Can you recommend a few? So she gave me a list of 5 agents. Now, this was a deal that was pretty much done. It was almost certain that they were going to buy this book. Mm. And I called up these 4 or 5 agents on the list. And, you know, some of them were at big agencies like William Morris and ICM, and some of them were boutique. And every single one of them said, oh, my God, this sounds like the book I have been looking for. This is absolutely what I want. Email me the manuscript. Of the 5 agents on the list, only 2 of them wanted to represent the book.
Wow.
Now, that's after you already have a publisher interested. And all they had to do is come in and present the paperwork, and they walk away with 15%.
Wow.
So you can't take it personally because they're really looking for something that speaks to them on a very deep level. And that's, you know, one thing that's great about the publishing industry. Mm. You know, unlike Hollywood where they'll just take whatever comes their way. I mean, they want to have a relationship with a writer, and they want it to be a lasting relationship. It hurt my feelings that this was not only a book that, a done deal almost, but it was a book that that they had told me they wanted. That was the kind of novel they were looking for.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So you can't take it hard when you get rejection. And the other example I can say is that when I was trying to get into Shouts and Murmurs in the New Yorker for a long time, I kept sending them, you know, piece after piece. I had a semi-okay relationship with the editor there. And, she wrote me back, yeah, this is great, this is funny, but it's not exactly what we're looking for now, or maybe we'll consider it later, or this doesn't work because it's a nah. And I was starting to get discouraged. And I tell this story to my students all the time. And then finally I thought, well, you know, Shouts and Murmurs at the New Yorker is not the only place to publish. You know, maybe I should send these pieces, which other people thought were pretty funny, somewhere else. So I had a relationship with A.J. Jacobs, who's the editor-at-large at Esquire. And I sent it over to him, and he loved this one in particular. But he couldn't get it published at Esquire because not enough people there were enthusiastic about it. And again, I kind of got discouraged. Oh, I'm such a crappy writer. I'm never going to publish anything in a big magazine. And lo and behold, about 2 months later, I get an email from AJ saying, you might be getting a call from Mental Floss. I told them all about you and how funny you are and blah, blah. So, and I went on to write for the magazine, and now, you know, I blog for them on a daily basis. So there's some trivia for you of how I came to blog at Mental Floss. But the lesson there is, you know, you can't get discouraged. You can't take it hard, and you have to keep doing it. And in this case, you know, it didn't get published. The piece actually wound up getting published in the Los Angeles Times eventually. But, you know, it became an opportunity elsewhere. And that's what I really stress with my students. Just keep writing, keep doing it, and if, you know, eventually somebody will take notice.
Yeah, that's great advice and great anecdotes to go along with the advice. It's good to hear from people who have been in the trenches and fought through it. David, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us this evening. This was a huge pleasure.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey, good luck with the baby.
Thanks.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, Chandra Prasad, author of On Borrowed Wings, will be with me. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
Hi, I'm attorney Mari Frank, co-host of Privacy Piracy. How private is your confidential information? Who is watching you on surveillance cameras or listening in on your private phone conversations? Think of all the information you give up each day, from the fast track scans on the morning commute to the credit card purchases at Starbucks to your cell phone tracking, airline ticket, car rental records, and even the logging of PC keystrokes at work. These bits of data are shared with companies and the government to create a detailed dossier of your daily activities. How are your profiles used, and what can you do to protect yourself? We'll answer these questions and more when you listen to Privacy Piracy, Wednesday evenings from 5 to 6 p.m. at KUCI 88.9 FM or www.kuci.org.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Get the lowdown on the publishing industry. Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett. She talks to anyone who's anyone in publishing. Thursdays, 5 p.m.
on KUCI-FM in Irvine.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. And as I mentioned earlier, this show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit penonfire.com for more details on that. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett, as I have been for much of this month. But fear not, she will be back again with you next week. Chandra Prasad is an alumni of Yale University. Before beginning her career in fiction, she had a freelance writing career focused initially on career and workplace issues. She gained recognition as an authority in her field and published dozens of articles, most notably in the Wall Street Journal, India Abroad, India New England, Monster.com, and Vault.com. At the age of 28, Chandra published her first book, Outwitting the Job Market. A combination of Southeast Indian, Italian, Swedish, and English, Chandra next set her sights on being the editor of and contributor to a book entitled Mixed, an anthology of short fiction on the multiracial experience. Chandra then spent months researching traveling circuses of the early 20th century for another book, Death of a Circus, published by Red Hen and out last year. But it's Chandra's newest work, On Borrowed Wings, that's at the center of the stage this evening. I'll allow her to introduce it and tell you what it's about. It was published by Atria and came out last month, and it's an absolutely stunning read. Let's bring Chandra on. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, thanks for being here. This was, as I mentioned, this was such a great read, and I wanted to give you the opportunity to introduce it to our listeners and kind of tell them what it was about.
Well, the book focuses on a girl named Adele Pietra, who's from a small quarry town in Connecticut, and the book takes place in the 1930s. Adele's situation is that her family is quite poor, and her father and brother work in the quarry as stone cutters. The mother is singularly obsessed with rising into affluence, and she sets her sights on the brother, Charles, her son, to attend Yale and to help thrust the family back into, I guess, a livable situation. Unfortunately, without giving too much away in the book, Charles is unable to attend Yale, and Adele, the daughter, decides that she will escape her rather dismal lot in life and attend Yale as her brother in the 1930s.
Yeah, it's... I see your hesitance to not want to say too much about it, but now I could be reading far too far into this, but I noticed that your main character's adopted name, as you said, is Charles Pietra.
Right.
Charles is Adele's brother. And perhaps this is a stretch, but the name doesn't feel so far off from your own name. And given your Yale connection, I'm curious to what extent, A, if that was intentional, and B, to what extent you found yourself identifying with this character?
Oh, well, that's a good question as far as the name goes. You know, I didn't do it intentionally, but maybe subconsciously it worked its way in there. I don't know. In terms of Adele's experience at Yale as a boy, I definitely did draw a little bit from my own experience at Yale. Not so much in terms of the situations and the scrapes and mishaps she gets into, but more in terms of the exuberance and excitement she feels freshman year. I remember my freshman year at Yale as definitely being the most memorable year, and I wanted to capture some of that in the book.
Yeah, and you certainly successfully did. And I hadn't realized until reading this and then doing research of my own that Yale didn't begin admitting women until 1970. And even then, they weren't far behind the pack of the Ivy League schools to accept women. You know, they were kind of right in there. Women were not accepted universally into Ivy League schools until, you know, well into the 70s. Is it still a difficult place today for women, you know, particularly women of color?
You know, it's hard to speak it's hard to speak universally to that, but it is pretty staggering that, like you said, 1969, 1970 was the time that Yale admitted women as undergraduates. I mean, it just wasn't that long ago. And I know for Yale, in terms of gender, they've made tremendous strides. I think 2 or 3 years ago, actually more female undergraduates were admitted than male undergraduates. So on that level, on just the topic of gender alone, I think tremendous gains have been made. And in terms of diversity, tremendous gains have been made. But is there room for improvement? I would say definitely, yeah.
Always.
Always, exactly.
Now, you alluded in your introduction of the book to the life in the quarry, and that was perhaps my favorite aspect of this novel, was the gorgeous details and descriptions of life in the quarry, where Adele lived before Yale. And in addition to being fascinating in its own right, it also served as, I thought, a really nice metaphor, sort of the grounding of rock and granite and its excavation as a counterpoint to what became another theme, which I want to talk about later, which is flight and kind of the lofty ideas of academic institutions. How did you arrive at the quarry, and can you talk about kind of what life is like there for just a moment?
Sure. I'm glad you like that section. That happens to be one of my favorite sections, too, the early scenes in the book. And Stony Creek is a real town in Connecticut. It's a shoreline town, and for decades, it was well known for having this very stunning pink granite, and it had tremendous industry going on because the stone was used all over not only the U.S. but the world, and it graces very famous monuments. Stony Creek granite is the base of the Statue of Liberty. It's the base of the Brooklyn Bridge. Walk down any street in New York, you're bound to see it as curbstone or on the base of buildings. I mean, it's just everywhere. And I guess I took notice just I just started taking notice of the granite around me, honestly, around New Haven, Connecticut, and around New York. And I started researching a little bit about the stone, and I guess it just comes to represent so much more than it is. The men, the quarrymen, worked this stone, and it was a very dangerous job. And they frequently died quite young, but I was struck by how their work tethered them to a greater history. You know, even though their lives ended much too soon, the monuments and the buildings still stand, and I think they still represent the hard work that these men did.
Yeah, it was, and your descriptions of, you know, certainly of the kind of pivotal scene, it's, I keep hesitating because I don't want to say too much. I don't want to give things away, but I encourage our listeners to check it out. It's really, really gorgeous stuff. You know, I also wanted to talk about this theme of flight because it runs, obviously, it runs through the title of the book. It ribbons through birds and obviously a fascination with Amelia Earhart at some points. Can you talk about that as a theme and kind of how and when it arose when you were writing the book?
Sure. It is a prominent theme, and a lot has to do with the fact that Adele, the main character, or Charlie, as she comes to be known, feels a great deal of liberation once she goes to Yale and kind of finds her own way. And flight seemed like the perfect metaphor for that. But it was also apt because I guess the field of aviation and women in that field especially was also taking flight. I mean, excuse the pun there. I mean, it really was. And in fact, in my research of Yale at that time, I found out that Amelia Earhart really did visit the campus and really did give a lecture very shortly before her, last attempt to circumnavigate the world. So it just seemed flight, aviation, birds, they all fed into the book in a really appropriate way.
Yeah, it was really gorgeous. It was really nicely done.
Thank
Amelia
you.
Earhart was really nicely done. She's, you know, such a perfect symbol for that time and place in history. Also, race versus gender. You know, I think your novel was almost, not quite, but almost as much about race and racial inequality as it was about gender inequality. And there's a chilling subplot with a eugenics professor that really mirrored those kind of pre-World War II, dawn of Hitler sort of times. And ultimately in the novel, eugenics suffers what I thought was a very satisfying blow. Very nicely done. Was that, in your research, was that representative of the times as well? Was there kind of a vocal percentage, I know it was kind of an academic percentage, but a vocal percentage of Americans who were pretty open to disputing eugenics in the 30s?
Yes. The scene, I mean, there was a vocal opposition to the eugenics movement, and certainly in the years preceding World War II, that voice was getting louder. But it just like the late admission rate for Yale in terms of women, the thriving eugenics movement came as a bit of a shock to me. There really was a kind of a eugenics department on campus. The journals that existed about human heredity and the right genes and the wrong genes and the right kind of head shape and the wrong kind of head shape, these kind of things. Just the whole pseudoscience around the eugenics movement was real, and it was very influential. It affected a lot of people on campus and a lot of people, obviously, nationwide and worldwide.
Mm. Yeah, that's amazing.
But I agree with you that in terms of that is a satisfying scene, that a blow is dealt to the movement by the narrator of the book.
Yeah, there are some wonderful twisting subplots. We'll get more into them. I should remind our listeners, I always forget to reintroduce the author in the book, but I'm talking with Chandra Prasad, author of On Borrowed Wings, that's out. It was out last month by Atria. Maybe before we delve any farther in, you could read to us a little bit and kind of bring our listeners into the world before we keep talking about the world.
Sure. The passage I'm going to read is, it's pretty early in the book. It's when Adele makes the decision that she is indeed going to try her hand at being male and see what opportunities that she can grab by going to Yale. But first, she has to train herself to be a boy, and that takes some work. Such begins the passage. There was much work to be done, the kind of work that one would never consider if not for the bizarre circumstances Mother and I had chosen to embrace. The haircut had been my initiation, but it wasn't enough, even when Mother coaxed it into submission with hairdressing. There were my mannerisms, soft and intimate, too many self-conscious flicks of my hands to my face, a habit of cupping my palm around my mouth when I was about to laugh. And there was my gait, wider and sturdier than that of most girls, but a gait that had adjusted to skirts, not trousers. Fortunately, my hands, rough and dark, passed muster. Mother told me to stop soothing them at night with her homemade balm. "They're right the way they are," she said. Smiling, she added sheepishly, "I never thought I'd hear myself say that." Some of the changes I enjoyed making, it was a relief, for instance, to toss aside the razor I had been using to shave my legs and underarms. I'd never been good at shaving, not since Mother had first showed me how, a cake of soap in one hand, a pitcher of warm water in the other. Never, ever go above the knees, Adele. I was forever nicking myself with the blade, rills of blood oozing down my shins. The hair that I shaved was fine and downy, not like the coarse little wires that had dotted Charles's skin. Still, Mother insisted that it would look authentic enough if it grew out. "You'll find out," she said with a smirk, "that there is considerable variation among men's bodies, and that men care more about some variations than others." My voice was the last stronghold, light and gossamer as corn silk. Whole afternoons, Mother and I worked on a deeper pitch. She gave me Charles's college entrance examination preparation materials, and these I read aloud with a voice that rose directly from my chest, the alto timbre of a different person. "Remember your laugh, Adele. It will give you away. A laugh is spontaneous, free of guile, and your laugh is like a bell, high and sweet." Each day, in between loads of laundry, we went through lessons from Charles's books, a swift yet necessary pace, for Yale would welcome its incoming freshmen in a matter of weeks. Mother seemed surprised by my aptitude. So confident she'd been that no student could have been more exemplary than her firstborn, she was genuinely stunned to find one under her own roof. Yet, if my ability caught her off guard, she was quick to cap her praise. "I read as many books as I could get my hands on when I was your age. And where did it get me? History is full of accounts of curiosity ruining women. Just look at Eve." Finally, there was my body itself, an entity that could not be tweaked or refashioned, only cloaked. Mother couldn't believe that after all of these years of bemoaning my curveless shape, she at last had reason to celebrate it. In my room, with the curtains drawn tight, she handed me one of Charles's shirts, one of two pairs of pants, and his only jacket. I thought the mere giving of these items might trigger her melancholia, but by then we were too headlong in emotion. We were charlatans now. We couldn't afford to wear our hearts on our sleeves when our sleeves were stuffed with tricks. Mother had hemmed Charles's pants and adjusted the inseams. Maybe I'll stop there unless you want me to go on.
No, that's really gorgeous.
Thank you.
Great. That was Chandra Prasad reading from her latest novel, On Borrowed Wings, out now by Atria Books. It's funny that you chose that passage to read, because I spoke with Nora Vincent a few months back, who wrote Self-Made Man.
That was a great book.
Yeah, it was her nonfiction piece on how she lived and worked and dated as a man for over 18 months. And I drew several interesting comparisons of her actual experience versus your literary experience. And one thing I noted, which I talked to her about as well, was this inclination to engage in self-mutilation or self-inflicted pain as, I guess, as a sort of penance for betraying people or something, and that existed in this book as well. And I was curious as to whether that was a researched detail or if it arose sort of naturally in your mind as you were writing it.
I'd say it was more in my imagination than anywhere else. I think Adele, she's grappling so hard to find herself in this very male place and to find the familiar in a totally foreign environment. And when it becomes just too overwhelming, when her work with the eugenics professor is leading her astray, when she starts to miss her father who has passed away, I think the way she can really feel is through pain and like you said, there is a bit of that in the book, and it just seemed to come naturally to this character as I was writing.
Yeah, it was so interesting because I also talked to Chris Abani, who wrote Virgin of Flames, and he was dealing with gender identity crisis as well. And he had a similar passage too. So I thought, this is so interesting. Each book I pick up on that deals with gender, you know, confrontation has kind of this element to it. And so when I came across that in your novel, I thought, oh my gosh, that's so interesting. Did you rely on nonfiction precedent of others, you know, of maybe Nora Vincent or others who were masquerading as men to gain acceptance? Did you rely on them as sort of research molds for this?
I've always been really keenly aware of stories of women masquerading as men because they had to, because they wanted to, or whatnot. And I was aware of Nora's book, and you know, there's huge literary precedent for what I'm writing about. Mm-hmm. I think what sets On Borrowed Wings apart is that it's as much an exploration of race and a class as it is of gender. It's really a more of a personal journey. It's something of a coming of age story. So it's not just purely about, you know, what is it like to go from being a woman to a man?
Right, right. Yeah, that actually brings me to, you know, so many of your minor characters were so rich and full. And it feels like within Yale in the 1930s, there would be a tendency to have very flat, sort of predictable, we know what these guys looked like characters. How did you go about the process of kind of rounding out these characters who could, you know, otherwise be easily flat and cliched?
Well, Adele is she's a special character. She's not your average student, certainly. And I wanted her to have friends that she could relate to in terms of their being imperfect as well. And what ended up happening, I think somewhat organically, is that as the three friends of hers, these are Harry, Wick, and Finn, these three boys and Adele or Charlie form this very close foursome. And what I ended up finding was that in their own way, each was an outsider too. Mm. Harry is Jewish, and there was a lot of anti-Semitism going on at Yale and other universities in the 1930s. Mm. He feels that acutely. Finn is a legacy student. He's from a wealthy family, and it's kind of, he's expected to be at Yale, and he's expected to be a certain way, but that's another part of the book I won't give away.
But he's not.
For a certain reason, he doesn't fit in. And then Wick is, I think, the boy that all of us know, or all of us knew while we were in school, this utterly charming, charismatic person that seems to float on air and walk on water. And he too, you know, that perfect image is it hampers him at Yale, and it makes him feel like a loner too. So in their own way, to reiterate, you know, they're all separate, and I think that separateness binds them.
Yeah, you really gave each one their just, you know, it's easy to let minor characters kind of fall away, and you really gave them their just time on the page. I thought that was really nice. Unfortunately, we're kind of running low on time, but I wanted to know, I guess this question is coming kind of late, but I was curious as to where this novel started in your mind. Did it start with an image or a character or a picture?
It started in a really simple way. I was at a history class at Yale, and I was just sitting there, and I literally just started thinking about how lucky I was to be there for so many reasons, but least of all that, you know, I wouldn't have been admitted a few decades earlier. And I started just becoming obsessed with that idea, that thought, that what would a girl have to do to attend Yale if it were prior to 1969? And the story naturally took shape from there.
Mm, that's amazing. And you, you're so prolific. You're really young. I'll just tell people you're really young. You've had three books out in within the past year. So I applaud that. Whatever parting advice you can leave us with to tell us how that gets done, I'd love to know.
Oh, that's sweet. You know, the one thing I can't say enough to any writer or aspiring writer is just really don't give up, because this industry is full of rejection. I mean, rejection is the norm. really got to just keep trying and keep plodding through and, you know, believe in yourself. It sounds simple or trite, but that's the bottom line.
Mm, that's, yeah, that's the theme of this evening. That was the prior guest, David Israel, left us with left us with similar thoughts, and
yeah.
I think it's so true. It's so true. Oh, Chandra, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us this evening. This was a huge pleasure.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks again. That was Chandra Prasad, author of On Borrowed Wings, available in bookstores now and published by Atria. That's unfortunately all the time we have for this evening. I took another quote from Eric Maisel's book, Creativity for Life. He was on the show last week, and if you missed it, you should check out the podcast because he really shared some informative and great stuff. This quote comes in a lost thing of my notes. Here it is now. This quote comes from Joan Miró. I always lose the quote at the end. A bit of thread can set a world in motion. I start with something considered dead and arrive at a world. And when I put a title on it, it becomes even more alive. Barbara DeMarco Barrett will be back with you next week in conversation with Meryl Marco and Allison Burnett. So until next time, thank you so much for joining me this evening. Good night. Be free, no.